It already seemed incredible that they'd been so scared of the blackbird. It wasn't very frightening now. It must have run through all its resources staging their job, and without Lionel and its hired hands, it was just a talking bird, nothing more. It didn't appear to want to leave.
"You have to help me."
"No," Plum said, looking up at it. "We really don't."
"The birds here despise me. I am very hungry. I have eaten garbage."
"I don't care what you've eaten," Quentin said. "We've got more important things to worry about. Leave or we'll throw you out." Though he wasn't exactly sure yet how they were going to catch and expel the thing. He wasn't looking forward to that chase scene.
"Please," it said again, "he will kill me."
"Who?" The blackbird didn't answer, just stared around the room anxiously from one to the other of them. It didn't want to say. Quentin didn't feel the slightest bit sorry for it.
"It's talking about Ember."
Even the bird jumped, as if it hadn't realized Alice could talk. Her expression didn't change. She wanted everybody to know that her emotional investment in this drama was nil.
"What did you say?"
"That's Ember's bird. I met it in the mirrors. It begged me not to kill it. I can't think why I didn't. I'm going to bed." On her way out, she nearly walked into a wall out of habit. As a Niffin, she would have gone right through it. She left an uncomfortable silence behind her. From behind the drawn curtains, they heard a truck come rattling slowly down the narrow street. Quentin waited for it to pass by.
"Is that true? Ember sent you?"
"Please."
It had lost all of its avian loftiness now. It trembled.
"He will kill me."
"He won't," Plum said, "because we'll kill you first."
"He sent me to get the suitcase. I do not know why. He would have sent a bigger animal," it added almost apologetically, "but he needed one capable of flight, to go through the mirrors. He gave me some money and the spell to make Lionel once I got here."
"Why did he want the case? Was it the knife or the book, or both?"
"I don't know," the blackbird wailed. "I don't know. I didn't know what was in it, truly."
And it began to cry. Quentin thought he had never heard a more pathetic sound. The bird fluttered down from its perch on the chandelier like a pheasant creased by a bullet. It landed on the coffee table and squatted there, sobbing. Something coherent was forming in Quentin's exhausted brain, like a crystal forming in a murky liquid. He'd been looking at chaos for so long he barely remembered what a pattern looked like, but now he thought he saw at least a fragment of one. "Hang on," he said slowly. "Let's think this through. Rupert stole the stuff in the case. Ember wants it back. He sends a bird to Earth to recover it for him. The bird hires us to find it." Plum picked up the thread. "The stuff in the case was Umber's, not Ember's, according to Rupert. But I guess they're brothers, so it's all in the family. But so why would Ember want it?"
"Why wouldn't he? Cool knife? Spell for making a magic land? Who wouldn't want that?"
"A god," Elliot said, "who already has a whole magic world?"
"Except he doesn't."
All the lights came on in Quentin's head at once.
"He doesn't, though. Fillory is dying and Ember has nowhere to go. He wants the spell so he can use it to make a new world. He's going to give up on Fillory, abandon it, and start over."
It came out in a rush, which was followed by a pause. Plum made a skeptical face.
"But it fits," Quentin said. "He's not even trying to save Fillory. He's a rat who won't go down with his ship."
"That," Elliot said, "is a mixed metaphor. And listen to me. I know you've got no reason to love Ember, but that seems a little cowardly."
"Yes, because he's a coward."
"Plus, you know the spell doesn't make a whole world, right?" Plum said. "Just like a land?"
"Maybe that's just us. Maybe a god could do more with it."
She looked up at the ceiling, considering. The blackbird watched all three of them desperately.
Even if that's true, Elliot said, what would we do about it? It's kind of depressing me, actually. Just more proof that there's no way out of this.
Quentin sat down. Maybe he was getting ahead of himself. We still have the spell, he said.
Destroy it, Elliot said.
No. He couldn't do that.
We have the bird, Elliot said. We could turn the tables, take it hostage.
Oh, come on. Ember doesn't give a crap about the bird. The bird's expendable.
The bird didn't object to this. It would have been hard to argue with.
We should go to Fillory, confront him, make him stay there and try and save it. He is the god of it, and we've got the spell.
God, what a bastard!
Or, Elliot said cautiously, maybe we want to get in on this shit. Maybe he's got the right idea. Maybe we should give him the spell and tell him to make a new world and take us with him.
Elliot, Quentin said,
I know. It would be a lot easier, though.
Elliot heaved himself wearily to his feet.
Fine, come on, let's go yell at a god. If nothing else, I want to hear him admit it. I want him to say it to my face.
I'm coming, Plum got up too.
Somebody should stay here with Alice, Quentin said.
Somebody young and inexperienced in the field, Elliot said.
No,
Plum glared at him, uncowed. No way, I'm not babysitting the blue meanie.
Maybe Alice will come with us. Maybe she can help.
Alice,
Quentin shouted up the stairs.
No answer.
I'll go talk to her.
Good luck with that.
Give me an hour.
I can help,
the bird said.
Quentin's reflexes were good, but it still only worked because he had the element of surprise. He darted his hand out and caught the bird around the neck. Ignoring its hysterical thrashing, he walked over to a window, opened it, and threw the blackbird out. Alice lay on her back on the bed with her eyes open. She heard the sounds of the house below her, walking, talking, shouting, slamming. But they were very far away. She stared at the ceiling. She felt like a marble figure carved on a tomb, her own tomb. This body was her coffin. She breathed shallowly. Even that was an imposition she could barely tolerate. She would not indulge this body. She didn't owe it anything. She wanted to feel it as little as possible. Clumping footsteps coming up the stairs. The door opened. Alice. It was Quentin, of course. She didn't turn her head. She heard the scrape of a stool as he pulled it over and sat down. She couldn't stop him.
Alice, we're going to go to the Netherlands. We have a theory about what might be going on. We're going to try to find Ember and talk to him.
Okay.
She felt her tongue, the worm in her head, lightly kiss the roof of her mouth to make the K. She didn't feel angry anymore. She wondered why she'd even bothered with all that anger, all that talking. Something had come over her, but now her rage was gone, a storm that had blown out to sea, leaving behind a great peace. A flat strand swept smooth by the violence of the waves, dotted with sea wrack churned up from the depths. She just didn't care.
I don't want to leave you here. I'd like you to come with us. I think you could help.
Very slightly, she shook her head. She closed her eyes. Sometimes when she closed her eyes, she felt weightless again. The whiskey helped. It was better when she was drunk. And it gave her pleasure to poison this body.
I don't think so.
7 years ago, he'd watched as she made a blue bonfire of her flesh. For 7 long years, her human self had slept, and she had roamed Fillory as a dream of rage and power. The dream was over now. Quentin had ended it. He'd woken her up and forced her back into her body. But he couldn't force her soul, herself. Did he actually hate her? That much. He said he loved her once.
That was both 7 years ago and yesterday. She wondered if she could burn again. Maybe she was like a spent match, to be struck only once, but she didn't think so. It would take time to get ready, to relearn the skills, but soon. She didn't mind if she died trying. Suicide was in everything she did now, and everything she thought. Suicide was her home. If she could find nothing else, then suicide would always have her. And if it did work, they would never catch her again. Never again. "I'm going to touch your hand now." She felt him take her fingers. She left hers limp. It was the first time anyone had touched her since she'd come back, and it made her skin crawl. "You're going to get through this. It's not as bad as you think. I'm going to try to help you, but you have to try, too."
"No," she whispered. "I don't."
Something happened in the silence that followed. Her eyes opened again. Something was pulling her back. It was something in the air, coming in through her nose and invading her mind. It was doing something to her.
Magic? Not magic. "What is that?" she said.
"What?"
"That smell."
"You know what it is," Quentin said. "Think." For an instant, she lowered her guard and forgot to fight, and in that instant, her body sat up and inhaled. Neurons were firing in her brain that hadn't fired for 7 years. After eons of disuse, mental furniture was being uncovered, dusty drop cloths yanked back. Mental windows were being thrown open to let in the hot sun.
"Bacon," she said.
He had a tray with him. Now he picked up a plate and held it in front of her. It was good bacon, quarter-inch thick strips, and it had warped and bubbled as he fried it. He'd let one end of it char a little because he knew she liked it burned, had liked it. Well, he'd done something with his 7 years. He didn't used to be able to cook worth a damn. She was tired, and she was famished. She wasn't. Her mind wasn't. It was clear as a bell, but this body was hungry, this doll made of meat. It was weak, and it reached out and picked up the food and put it in her mouth. The meat took over and ate the other meat. And God, it was fucking unbelievable, salty and fatty and smoky. When she was done, she licked her thumbs and wiped her greasy hands on the sheets. It revolted her. She revolted herself, but there was so much pleasure in it. She was trying to reject her body like a bad organ transplant, but she could feel herself trapped in its sticky embrace. It was trying to adhere to her, trying to become her, and Quentin was helping it. He was on its side. "I hope," she said, "that you don't think you're going to keep me here with bacon." "Not just bacon." He handed her a plate with fresh slices of mango on it, intensely orange, like little arcs carved off a tiny sweet sun. She fell on them like an animal. She was an animal.
No, she was not. She was pure and beautiful and blue. "Why did you do it?" she asked with her mouth full. "Why did you do this to me?"
"Because this is who you are. Because you're human. You're a person. You're not a demon."
"Prove it."
"I am proving it." She looked at him, really looked for the first time since she'd been back. He had a narrow, symmetrical face, rendered interesting by a slightly too large nose and an expressive, too wide mouth. He never knew it, which had saved him from developing one of those pretty boy personalities. But objectively, he'd always been handsome, and he still was. But he was different now, too.
He didn't stutter or duck her gaze the way he used to. He was right. He had changed.
"You could have got oysters," she said.
"You hate oysters."
"Do I?"
"You used to say they were like cold snot."
"I can't remember. What else do I like?"
"Hot baths, fresh socks, really big sneezes, that feeling when you successfully flip a pancake. And this." He gave her a square of chocolate, good chocolate, and when she tasted it, she actually shed tears.
Jesus, she was losing all control. All control. Was the flesh going to win? It was getting harder to disentangle herself from it. The triumphant, righteous Niffin in her shrieked defiance. She thought of flying, of plunging into the earth and flying again, of burning things, making them hurt the way she hurt, showing them how glorious the pain was. She shuddered. "Why did you come here?" he said.
"To kill you."
She said it without hesitating, because it was true. "No. You came here so I could save you." She laughed. Yes, that sick, wicked Niffin laugh. She still had it. She loved it. But she couldn't let the food alone either. They were forcing her, making her give it up. "I'm going to make my new body fat," she said. "I'm going to eat until it is morbidly obese and I die."
"You can if you want to.
Here." A noise. What was it? Her body seethed with pleasure at it. He had opened a cold, sweating bottle of champagne and was pouring some into a wine glass. "This is hardly fair," she said.
"I never said it was."
"You want me to drink champagne out of a wine glass? You've gone downhill, Quentin Coldwater."
Where were these words coming from?
"I've adjusted my priorities."
When she had drunk it, sitting up in bed, taking quick little sips like a child taking her medicine, she burped loudly.
"That might be my favorite part," she said. "Is this all you have?"
"That's all I have."
"No, it's not," she said.
Abruptly, awkwardly, like an inexperienced schoolgirl, she kissed him. She did it roughly and hard, without knowing she was going to do it. She leaned forward and mashed her lips against his, felt a tooth grind into her lip, tasted blood. As she did, something warmed and melted between her legs. She shoved her tongue into his mouth, let him taste the champagne. The dike that kept her mind separate from her body was leaking in 100 places. Somewhere far away, her glass smashed on the floor. She wanted him. She was remembering things, afternoons upstairs at the cottage in the stifling heat. He was lean and strong, stronger than he used to be, and she wanted him.
"Show me, Quentin," she ordered him. "Show me what bodies are for."
She was unbuttoning his shirt, but clumsily, she'd forgotten how. He trapped her hands.
"No," he said. "Not yet. Too soon."
"Too soon?"
She grabbed the front of his shirt and kissed him again. His stubble scraped her. She smelled him. It wasn't like bacon, but it was still good.
"You do this to me and then you tell me it's too soon?"
He was trying to get up.
"The little shit."
Anger came so easily still, with all those lovely anger words, too. Rage combined with the pleasure, but it couldn't dispel it.
"Hang on, Alice. This isn't how it works." "Then show me how it works."
She got up, too, advancing on him. She felt like an animal, a predator. She wanted to pin him and devour him.
"Does my body disgust you as much as it disgusts me?"
"Too bad. You brought me back. You show me it was worth it." She was wearing one of his shirts, and it was big enough that she could pull it over her head in one angry swipe and drop it on the floor,
leaving her naked except for a pair of underpants. Alice kissed him again, pushed herself against him, felt the electric roughness of his shirt on her breasts. He stumbled back until his head knocked against the door. With her hand, she found his crotch and massaged it. Yes, that's how it went. He used to like this. He still did. He was getting hard under her hand. Isn't this why you brought me back? So you could fuck me like you used to? Even she didn't believe that, but it was the cruelest, bitterest thing she could think of. She wanted to do violence to him, the kind of violence he'd done to her, but he didn't waver. I didn't bring you back for me. And then he did kiss her. Not hard, but gently and firmly. That was it. You could do it that way, too. He wrapped his arms around her, fitting her body against his, her head beneath his chin, and just held her. Memories inundated her. Human memories. The night they walked out from Breakbills in the snow, and he'd put his arm around her shoulders. The day in Antarctica when they were foxes and he chased her the way she'd wanted him to do when they were human. The way he looked at her as if there was nothing else in the world for him but her. As if he loved her as much as she hated herself. He was looking at her that way now. Suddenly she felt desperate to connect to him again. She'd been alone for so long. She needed this. Along with so many other things, she'd forgotten what it was like to need. She put her hand up under his shirt, felt his smooth skin. Something strange had happened to his shoulder. She rested her head flat against his chest.
"It hurt, Quentin," she said. "It hurt so much when I died."
"I know. But this is going to feel good." Afterward, they lay next to each other on the bed. It had worked, for now. Her body had gotten what it wanted. Not once, but twice, which, if she remembered correctly, had been rather a rarity in the old days. But then again, Quentin had had some practice since then.
Poppy. Why had she watched him with Poppy? It had seemed so funny at the time, but now it hurt her. She wished she could forget it.
She scooched away from him. She wanted to go away again. She let herself fall into herself, falling and falling, pulling away into the inner darkness, dreaming of flying. She withdrew inside her body like a timorous crab inside an enormous whelk. She had felt so human before, so her old self, but she was losing it, and she let it go. She had thought for a moment that it was simple, but she was remembering that it wasn't. He sat up and started putting his clothes on. "I have to go," he said, "to the Netherlands, to find Ember. Come with me." She shook her head. She wanted him gone. It was so much easier this way. He was gathering up her clothes, too. "Alice." She didn't react. She would sleep now. "Alice, I want you to know that I mean it in the kindest possible way when I say that you are being the most unbelievable pussy." He took her hand again, and they vanished, both of them together. Chapter 28. They were going to all go together, and from a tactical perspective, Plum thought it would have been a better idea, but Elliot was getting impatient, and then there were the noises. From upstairs, Quentin and Alice. Plum and Elliot exchanged looks and nodded. No words were needed. It was probably a good development for all involved, on balance, but seriously, they were not going to hang around and listen to that. Elliot made a big show about how interdimensional travel was really no big whoop to him anymore, but Plum was not going to let him ruin it for her. This was radical magic, world-expanding stuff,
and even under the present grimish circumstances, she was a complete nerd for that shit. She could hardly wait. He held out his hand, in a foppish kind of a gesture, and she took it, and he put his other hand in his pocket, and...
Oh! Clear, cold water.
They were floating in it, floating upward. In spite of herself, she laughed with pleasure and as a result almost choked on magic water. They rose up toward light, points of it, glittery and diffuse above them, but getting more focused all the time, and then their heads broke the surface. It wasn't what she was expecting, not based on what she'd heard. They were inside somewhere, in a vast room lit by two chandeliers, treading water in what looked more like an indoor swimming pool than a fountain.
"What the hell?"
Elliot said. He seemed, if anything, more surprised than she was. The pool was sunk level with a marble floor. Water trickled into it from the open mouth of an angry stone face at one end. At the other end, steps led up and out like a Roman bath, blue water graduating stair by stair, up to clear. They stroked over to them, in sync.
"This isn't right," Elliot said. "This isn't the Netherlands, I don't think. We've been hijacked. Button-jacked."
Magic water streamed out of their clothes as they climbed out, leaving them instantly dry.
Awesome.
The walls of the room were covered in bookshelves.
"Who puts a fountain in the middle of a library?" Plum said.
"It can't be good for the books."
"No, it can't."
It was a library, maybe the grandest one Plum had ever seen. She would have known it was a library with her eyes shut. The hush of it was enough, like a velvet nest in which she'd been carefully nestled, and the smell, the heavy, spicy aroma of slowly, imperceptibly decomposing leather and paper, of hundreds of tons of dry ink. Every square foot of the walls was bookshelves, and every foot of every shelf was full. Creamy spines, leather spines, knobby and ribbed spines, jacketed and bare, gilded and plain, blank spines and spines crammed with text and ornament. Some were thin as magazines, some were wider than they were tall. She ran her fingers along them, one after the other, as if they were the long back of some giant, friendly vertebrate that she was petting. In three or four places a book had been taken down, and the one next to it was left slightly aslant, leaning its head against its fellow, as if in silent mourning for its absent neighbor. Even the beams and buttresses had been fitted with shelves, rows and arches and fans of books. In the corners of the room up near the ceiling, there were little book-sized doors, like cat doors. As she watched, one of them swung open with a squeak, and a book came through, floating in midair, sailed the length of the room, and left through a cat door on the other side.
"I take it back," Elliot said. "I think this must be one of the libraries of the Netherlands. I've never been inside one."
"I thought normal people weren't supposed to be allowed in them."
"You're not."
The voice came from a doorway behind them. It belonged to an odd-looking man, 30-ish, shaved head, his face round and doughy as an unbaked biscuit. He had a goatee that was maybe growing into something that was more than a goatee, which made him look like an angry barista at an indie coffee shop whose dreams of becoming a successful screenwriter were dwindling by the hour. He wore what looked like a monk's robe and sandals, but the oddest thing about him was his hands. They were magical constructs of some kind, golden and translucent, and they gave off their own warm, honey-colored light. He held them clasped in front of him.
"Penny," Elliot said.
It wasn't so much a greeting as a statement of fact.
"The rest of your party should be arriving momentarily."
Sure enough, up popped Quentin and Alice, her sputtering and blowing and apparently furious, big surprise. She favored Quentin with a murderous look, then swam breaststroke over to the steps, at which point it became apparent that she was completely naked.
What, did they roll over onto the button halfway through?
Best not to think about it. Alice didn't seem at all self-conscious. Quentin followed and handed her clothes, which she put on clumsily.
Hi, Penny, Quentin said. Good to see you. Did you just kidnap us?
That was my question, Elliot said.
I diverted you. All the ways of the Netherlands are now mine to command. You are here as my special guests.
Plum was getting the impression they all knew each other already.
Isn't the water bad for the books? Plum said.
We have taken precautions. Shelf space is a precious resource here. Nothing is wasted.
That's great, Penny, Quentin said. But we're actually in kind of a hurry. Important business, really time-sensitive.
I require your presence. I will explain.
Well, thanks, Quentin said. But, you know, be quick. Nice hands.
Thank you. I made them myself.
The dime dropped. The people who'd jumped them in Connecticut had had golden hands, too, exactly the same. Maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe there had been a sale. But Plum doubted it, in which case she had a bone to pick with this Penny, maybe several bones.
This is our friend Plum, Quentin said. Plum, this is Penny. And you remember Elliot and Alice.
Hi, Plum said.
Alice said nothing.
Pleased to meet you.
Plum was a little bit relieved that he didn't try to shake her hand.
It's good to have you back with us, Alice.
While saying nothing about it, Penny somehow managed to convey that he and Alice had once slept together.
Penny, Elliot said, you should know that we really
walk with me.
Penny turned and strode into the next room without waiting to see if they were going to follow him.
Who is this guy?
Plum whispered to Quentin. We went to college together.
They followed him. The next room was, if anything, even grander, a vaulted hall, also full of books, but with soaring high windows that were dark and flecked with light rain.
Through the lower panes, Plum got her first look at the Netherlands, a gray warren of broad squares and narrow alleys and Italianate palaces. It was night. Penny walked with his magic hands clasped behind his back.
The past year has been good to me, he said,
the gracious tour guide.
My work defending the Netherlands and safeguarding the flow of magic brought me to the attention of my superiors in the order. We take care of the Netherlands, Plum, in case they haven't told you. At the same time, we suffered significant losses of personnel, which created gaps in the leadership. I was advanced rapidly. The promotion was gratifying, of course, but the challenges have been non-trivial. The Netherlands was changed irreversibly in the late catastrophe. Much of the old magic no longer works, or works differently. Things grow here now. There is time here. He said it irritably, like they had a case of bedbugs. You cannot imagine the inconvenience of it. But the upshot was that I was awarded the position of librarian. It is one of the most prestigious titles a member of my order can hold.
Congratulations, Quentin said. I've always wondered, though, what happened to the dragons? The last time I saw them, they were getting ready to fight the gods.
The dragons succeeded. If they hadn't, you would not have lived to play your part in the crisis. Fighting the old gods, even distracting them, is of course a chancy business. There's an art to it. They don't really counterattack so much as just delete you from reality. But some of the dragons survived. They will repopulate if they can remember how. I believe it has been several millennia since any of them had sex. We in the Order have been assisting them with the research.
Plum guessed it stood to reason that out of all these billions of books, at least one of them had to be dragon porn. They left the great hall and entered a low labyrinth. Even there the walls were books,
even the ceiling. They hung spine down, somehow, over their heads, like bats in a cave. Every once in a while, large swathes of books shifted themselves over, grudgingly, like sleepers in a crowded bed, to make room for some new addition further down the line. This Penny guy was a bit of a pill, but she had to admit she was loving his library. Loving. If anything, Quentin had undersold this place. It made her wonder if they'd undersold Fillory, too. She felt herself very close to Fillory now, just one fountain away, closer than she'd ever been. When she was kicked out of Breakbills, Plum thought her life had gone straight off the rails, right into the muddy and unsanitary ditch by the side of the tracks, and maybe it had. Like Quentin said, there's no one to tell you what would have happened after the fact. But it had also brought her here, right to Fillory's very threshold. She wanted to see it. It was time. Plum spotted a narrow, olive-green volume with silver type on its spine, dangling above her. It was so tempting, like ripe fruit. Ah, ah, ah! Penny practically slapped her hand away. It was a measure of how out of her depth she felt that she actually blushed. But Penny was off and away again.
I've already instituted some improvements that have been very well received. I don't know if you've noticed.
He pointed up at one of the cat doors through which books were entering and exiting at irregular intervals.
Yes, very nice, Elliot said.
Some of your best work, Quentin chimed in.
Plum was picking up a significant frenemy vibe off the Quentin-Penny dynamic.
They've been adopted by several other libraries.
Good for cats, too, Plum said, though they'd have to be flying cats.
No animals, domestic or otherwise, are allowed in the building,
Penny said without humor.
We really have to go, Elliot said. Really.
I've set aside a special room here for problem formats.
Curious, in spite of herself, Plum poked her head in through the open door. It was the weirdest bibliographical menagerie she'd ever seen, books so tall and yet so narrow that they looked like yardsticks. She supposed they must be illustrated guides to snakes or arrows or maybe yardsticks. One book was kept in a glass terrarium, a librarium, the better to contain the words that kept crawling out of it like ants. One lay slightly open on a table, but only slightly, so you could see that its pages emitted an intolerably bright radiance. A welding mask lay next to it. One book appeared to be all spine along all of its edges. It was unopenable, its pages sealed inside it.
Honestly, you wonder who publishes these things?
Penny shook his head, and they kept walking. It was a little like touring a chocolate factory, except with books, and starring Penny as a wonky Willy Wonka. Other adepts, wearing robes that were similar to Penny's but not as nice, bustled by them, nodding deferentially to him as they passed. Some of them had the golden hands, too.
There are catacombs underneath the library, Penny said. That's another special collection. It's all the novels people meant to write but didn't.
Oh, Elliot brightened up. Can I go see mine? I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty sure it's going to be amazing.
You're welcome to try. I spent far too much time looking for mine. You can't find anything down there, he sounded exasperated. But here's something people always want to see.
This room had only one bookcase in it, on the back wall, but that proved to be deceptive because apparently it was infinitely extendable. Penny took hold of one of the shelves and gave it a sideways shove, and it zipped along like a conveyor belt at amazing speed, frictionlessly, while the shelves above and below it stayed still. It reminded Plum a little of the motorized racks at a dry cleaner's. Then Penny stopped it and pushed up on it, only lightly, just a touch, and the whole business began scrolling upward, shelf after shelf after shelf, as if it went on and on beyond the room in all directions,
for unknown leagues.
"What is this?" Plum asked.
"These are everybody's books, or rather the books of everybody."
"I don't understand."
"Hang on, I'm looking for ours."
They spun by, thousands and thousands of them, until Penny stopped the bookcase with one hand.
"These are the books of our lives. Everybody has one. See, here we are, all together, as it happens, one book for each of us."
"You must be joking," Quentin said quietly. Not that Penny ever joked, as far as Plum could tell.
"Not at all. Here is Plum's."
He put a finger on one spine. The book had, appropriately enough, a plum-colored dust jacket.
"Mine?"
Penny's was tall and thin and bound in smooth, pale leather, with his name clearly etched in black up the spine in a no-nonsense sans-serif font. It looked like a vintage technical manual.
"They're next to each other?" Plum said. "Please tell me that doesn't mean we get married."
"I don't know what it means. Nobody knows much about these things."
"Your middle name is seriously Schroeder?" Elliot said. Like that was the surprising thing here. "You're not going to tell me there's one of these for every person who ever lived," Quentin said.
"Only people who are alive have them. They come and go as people are born and die. This shelf goes on for miles in all directions. It must jut into some separate subdimension. I don't know where they go when you die. Remaindered, I suppose."
He tittered at his own joke.
"What's in them?"
"About what you'd expect. The story of your life, start to finish. Who you are and what you did and what you're going to do. Elliot's is in two volumes. Here's yours."
Penny put his hand on a squat, navy-blue volume, as chunky as an unabridged thesaurus, with Quentin's name stamped on it in gold. Quentin hesitated.
"I know," Penny said more quietly. "Not as tempting as you'd think, is it? I've never opened mine. There are those in the order who have looked, and I've seen their faces."
Plum slid her volume off the shelf and held it, cradled in her hand, like a baby. The urge to read it was almost overpowering. Almost, but not quite.
"You spend your whole life trying to understand yourself, what your story is about," Penny said, "and then suddenly it's all there, all the answers, spelled out in black and white. Some of them are indexed, even. Look at Quentin's. It's alphabetized."
It was true. There were little half-moons cut into the pages, labeled A through B, C through D, and so on, in a diagonal ladder down the side. Slowly, reluctantly, Quentin handed his book back to Penny. "I guess I'm supposed to be writing it," he said, "not reading it." Penny reshelved it, a little cavalierly, Plum thought. Plum replaced hers with appropriate care. You can't unread a book. She was dying to look, but she supposed that if she lived her life properly, then by the time it was over, she'd know what was in it. That was sort of the whole point, wasn't it? To understand your own story? Reading the book now would just be cheating, and what kind of jackass cheats at life?
"Hang on," Elliot said. "This raises a lot of questions. Does this mean we don't have free will? And if you burn somebody's book, do they die?"
"Keep moving,"
Penny shooed them out into the hall.
"There's a lot to see. I thought you were in a hurry."
He hustled them along as far as a plain, unmarked door, which he opened. It was the first room they'd seen that was completely empty of books. There was nothing on the walls, not even a picture. It had no windows either, only a desk with a leather chair behind it. In fact, it was rather gloomy.
"Let me guess," Plum said. "Invisible books. Or no, microscopic, like they're in the air and we're breathing them." "This is my office."
Penny sat down at the desk, facing them, and steepled his eerily luminescent fingers.
"The system notified me as soon as you entered the Netherlands. There's a reason I brought you here."
"You have literally 3 minutes," Elliot said. He was practically fidgeting with impatience.
"You have something of mine," Penny said. "Quentin."
"I do."
"A page from one of my books."
"Oh." Everybody looked at Quentin. Plum hadn't thought of that, but she guessed it made sense. Probably, technically, Quentin had stolen that page from the Netherlands, but even so, Penny was being kind of scoldy about it. "Fair enough." Quentin extracted it from his coat pocket. "I took good care of it for you, I promise." The page, with what seemed to Plum like a certain lack of sentimentality, slipped out of Quentin's hand of its own volition and through the air and onto Penny's desk, like a toddler rushing to embrace its parent.
"Thank you."
Instantly, a door opened and a robed woman entered, eyes on the floor, as if to avoid gazing directly at Penny's magnificence. She took the page, bearing it in both hands as gingerly as if it were a limb in urgent need of reattaching, which Plum supposed in some sense it was. Penny leaned over and pulled up one of the floor tiles next to his chair, which turned out not to be a tile at all, but the cover of a large book. It was embedded in the floor. Plum looked around. They were standing on books, big, dusty, thickly bound tomes fitted together like flagstones. Penny leafed through the tissue-thin pages, which contained columns of minute numbers, nodded, and then let the cover fall closed with a thump.
"Now," he said, "there is the matter of the fine."
"A fine?" Quentin said. "You mean like a late fee?"
"I do. You will be detained here for 1 year to work in the stacks until your debt is repaid."
"Oh, my God, what an ass."
"Don't be an ass," Plum said.
"You're not going to detain me," Quentin said. "Penny, Fillory is dying. We might be able to save it, but it can't wait. We have to go."
"There are thousands of worlds. They live and they die. But knowledge is power, Quentin, and wisdom is eternal."
He actually talked like that.
"You took some of ours. I gave it back. But you had the use of it for a year, a page from the Arcana Arcanorum in the hand of the Zweivögel scribe herself. Think what we could have done with it in that time."
"Almost certainly nothing. You have like a dillion books here. Probably nobody would have even looked at it." Penny stood up and walked around from behind the desk, raising his hands, his fingers. Hey, those were spellcasting positions.
"The books must be balanced, Quentin. You always did have trouble accepting that. We will also have to remove from your mind the memory of what you read."
He was going into Quentin's head now? No. Plum took a step back and raised her hands, too. Everybody did. In 1 second, they went from a loose clump of people with complicated feelings about one another to a single defensive phalanx. Quentin moved the fastest. He held up a hand and a tight, blinding shaft of light shone out of his palm, straight into Penny's face. But the light didn't reach his face. With one weird magic hand, Penny stopped the beam. His hand seemed to eat the light. With the other, he grasped the beam like it was a solid thing and bent it 90 degrees downward so that it shone harmlessly at the floor. It stayed there. Too late, Elliot chimed in with some kind of electric bolts, but those golden hands plucked them out of the air, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in sequence, and with inhuman quickness and accuracy. It was like a stage magician's bullet catch. Plum was frantically weaving a shield in front of Quentin. She was still weak on this kind of magic. Nobody at Breakbills taught it, but Quentin had showed her a thing or two, and she was nothing if not a quick study. But she already knew it wasn't going to be ready in time.
I've waited a long time for this, Penny said.
Then this is going to be kind of an anticlimax, Alice said, and she punched him in the face. Boom!
Oh, my God, it was beautiful, just like in a movie, straight from the shoulder, feet planted, hips rolled, follow through, the works. Penny never saw it coming. Do people really do things like that?
People like Alice did, apparently. Penny didn't fall down, but he bent over double, clutching his face with both hands.
He said it quietly, but with real feeling. We're done, Alice said. Let's go.
Quentin looked at Alice with an expression Plum had never seen on him before. Love, she guessed it was. It was as bright as that beam he'd shot out of his hand.
Penny, Quentin said, I don't know what you would have done with that page, but I'll tell you what I did with it. I made Alice human again, in case you were wondering how that happened. You're a great magician, you always have been, and I'm sure you're a pretty great librarian, too. Magic and books, there aren't many things more important than that, but there are one or two. We saved Alice, and now we're going to save Fillory. Please don't get in our way, that's all I ask.
Penny was bent over, working his jaw, both hands pressed to his cheek. He raised his face at them blearily as they filed out, Alice in the lead. She was studying the knuckles of her right hand.
For a second there, she said, I saw the point of being alive.
I'm glad you are, Quentin said. You're pretty good at it.
Can we get out of here now? Elliot said. But Plum had a thought. Hang on, she said. Somewhere in this building there must be everything there is to know about Fillory, don't you think? Maybe before we go we should do a little research?
Penny came running up behind them, with a reddening scuff mark on his cheekbone, but otherwise steady on his feet. Plum would say this for him. He was impervious to embarrassment.
Don't say anything, Elliot said, before Penny could speak. Just listen. We need information. You have it. Where are the books about Fillory?
There's a whole room of them.
Plum deplored physical violence on principle, but it did seem to have a remarkably positive effect on Penny.
Large one. Come on, it's in the other wing.
They never would have found it on their own. Even with Penny leading the way, it took 10 minutes to walk there, up and down stairs and through a maze of passages. On the way, Penny explained about his hands. They were a form of spectral prosthetic, quite groundbreaking in their own way. The theory was very elegant, but the concepts were likely beyond what most of them, except for Alice, were capable of understanding. His fingertips could move at several times human speed, and they had a number of extra senses, including the ability to feel magnetic fields and refract light and gauge temperature to within a hundredth of a degree. He had something of a cult of personality going among the sub-librarians, Penny went on, and a number of them had arranged for their own hands to be painlessly, hygienically, removed and replaced with magical prostheses to match his. Plum was finally on the point of asking him about Connecticut when they arrived at a room that could have been a ballroom at Versailles, an immense expansive space with windows along one wall and the wall opposite paneled in books, 2 stories high, traversed by one spindly rolling ladder. Penny was back to playing the host. It was a role he obviously enjoyed.
Stand back against the windows. That way you'll get the full effect.
They did, and they did. Taken as a whole, the spines of the Fillory books formed a faint, ghostly outline, which even Plum recognized as a map of Fillory itself, the size of the entire wall. Each book did its part. The blues were the ocean, and the pale greens and browns were the land. Up close, Plum never would have seen it, but now, looking at them all together, she couldn't see anything else.
Beautiful, Quentin said.
So can we look at the books? Plum asked. It was a measure of how much the power had shifted since Alice punched him.
that Penny pursed his lips with distaste, but then nodded reluctantly.
"Just don't reshelve them. Please leave it to the professionals."
It was hard to know where to begin. Elliot didn't even move. "Penny," he said, "you're the expert on the Netherlands. What happens when a world ends?"
"Pretty much what you'd expect. The land dies. Over time, the world disintegrates and ceases to exist."
"What happens here? I mean, what happens to the fountain?"
"Oh, it dries up, falls into disrepair. It's a mysterious process, but consistent with the integrity of the Netherlands as a whole, so we allow it to happen."
"Here's what I'm wondering. Could the tail wag the dog, so to speak? What if you repaired the fountain, rebuilt it or replumbed it or what have you? Would that bring a dead world back to life?"
Penny thought for a minute, his lips moving silently. He walked up the length of the ballroom and then back to where the rest of them stood.
"It's not as stupid as it sounds," he announced. "But no, you couldn't bring it back that way. You could wag the tail, but the dog would still be dead."
Elliot nodded sadly.
"That was my last idea. I didn't really expect it to work." The fire had gone out of him.
"Look, this is going to take forever. Let's just go straight to the fountain."
"I need to do something first," Plum said. "Watch this. A magic trick."
She'd seen it almost as soon as they walked in. She was just waiting for her moment. Plum walked right up to the enormous wall of books, feeling very small with the ranks of them towering above her. There was one narrow gap, a thin space where a single volume was missing. She took her great-grandfather's memoir out of her bag. Penny's face went slack when he saw it.
"The door in the page," he said in a childlike voice. "It's the holy grail of Fillory books, the last and rarest one. I've been hunting it for so long."
She went to slide it in, paused, reflected, turned it the other way up, then shelved it. It fit perfectly, not just the size, but the pattern. The spine was the perfect shade of a pale green, with a band of light blue near the top to fill in the last bit of the lower slosh, and a sliver of the burnt river to go with it. It was so satisfying, like finishing an enormous jigsaw puzzle, that her fingers tingled, and she involuntarily let out a breath. She was playing her part in the Chatwin story now. No more lingering in the wings. She was on stage in the thick of it. She'd done what she could. She had brought Rupert home, or as close as he would ever get.
"Hey, Penny, is it?" Plum said. "That ought to pay for Quentin's library fines, don't you think? Or Alice could just punch you again. It's all good."
But Penny's attention was completely occupied by his new acquisition. He went trotting up to it, half running across the shiny ballroom floor, and slid it gingerly out again, touching only the upper edges of its pages in order to spare the spine. He let it fall open and sniffed the paper.
"How did you get this?"
"Stole it."
"We tried to steal it, too."
"I know," Plum said. "From us. Next time, try harder." The failure didn't appear to sting Penny. He looked like a little boy with a new puppy. It was weird. He was obviously an asshole, but he wasn't a sociopath. He had feelings. In fact, from the way he held the book, it looked like he had an enormous capacity for love. He just wasn't very good at loving people, apart from himself. Only Elliot looked grave.
"I just thought of something," he said. "That was the last book. The wall's full. The map is finished. That must mean the story's over. Fillory's history has been written. The apocalypse must have already come."
"You don't know that," Quentin said.
"Yes, I do," Elliot snapped, "and don't try to make me feel better."
"Could it be true?"
The idea made its way through Plum in a cold ripple. All this time, all her life, really, she'd been thinking about Fillory, dithering about it, hiding from it. Fillory and the Chatwins and the fatal longings they represented had been her dark